the JRR. You talking to me? Podcast. I don't see anyone else here, but we do have Jude Fox on the line. Jude, are you talking to me tonight?
I will be whispering deep, sweet nothings into your ear holes all night long.
Okay, I'll try to burn that out of my mind. So, we got the Helm's Deep Dive for episode 3, and we're going to talk about some book lore to show comparisons. We're going to talk about Numenor. We're going to talk about Lady Galadriel. We're going to talk about the massive timeline compression in general. Offer some opinions on the technical aspects of the show, the look of the show, maybe some comments about the music, and maybe get into some Easter eggs if we find some. And also, we're going to talk about some topics like the use of different ethnic groups in the show and how we feel about that. And what is fan fiction? And what is the nature of adaptation in general? And what we're watching, is it fan fiction? Is it adaptation? I don't know. Jude, so first thing that I'd like to talk about is the timeline. And we talked about this in the pre-show podcast, the very first one, episode 0. And what have you to say about this massive timeline compression? Does it bother you? Is it okay? What do you think?
Well, I've got no actual issues with it whatsoever. I think that when you're adapting a story into a visual medium, whether it's movies, television, etc., you need to make these kind of compressions, and although some purists might have issue with it, I have none.
Well, agreed. I have no issue with it, although it is a bit confusing when you actually try to conceive where things are happening, and I'm going to just try to break it down so that we can actually compare the book lore to what we're seeing in the show. Because really what it amounts to is we're seeing the plot points and characters of the Second Age all thrown together into one era. And I think what that means for people who are familiar with the lore is that we're going to see three major conflicts with Sauron possibly put into one conflict. And so what does that mean? That means that when we take a look at the timeline, we have about 2,000 years that actually happen. These characters and these events happen over the course of 2,000 years.
Maybe a little longer.
A little bit longer. So it's 1,200 when Annatar deceives Celebrimbor and the elves, the Gwythai Merdain.
Not all the elves, huh?
No. Gil-galad was not deceived. He went to Lindon first. He's like, you know, I'm going to check out Lindon. I heard it's nice. But
yeah, and he told Sauron, you know, go take your shit, take it somewhere else, have fun. I'm not interested.
Yeah, guy who isn't Sauron.
Annatar. Well, Annatar.
So,
bringer of gifts. Giver of gifts.
I wonder what he brought him.
Well, I mean, if you want to get into the gifts I think he brought him, I think that's a whole different show.
You know, it's probably like a really nice pot of jam.
Yeah, that's where I was going with that.
You know. Oh, that's nice. That's cool. So that happens in 1200, okay? And now this another event that we're looking at is the first war of Sauron against the elves, which is 1693 that begins. Okay, this was,
let's just make it clear for people, this was after the forging of the rings, though.
Correct. And he's coming to get the rings.
Yes, he is by then made the One Ring. The elves at this point know that the three that were made for the elves are tied to the One Ring, even though the attempt was to make them independently. And they now know that they have to do something about the threat.
Right, and it's basically the conflict that is inevitable in this show, because it is the Rings of Power show, after all. So we're looking at, this is going to be one of the aspects, one conflict that's going to be conflated. There are going to be three that are conflated into one, and this is one of the three. Also, by the way, in 1700, the Numenoreans under Tar Minister helped defeat Sauron. They joined with the elves, and this was before there was any animosity towards the elves. But it was actually the seed of when the animosity started in 1700. Now, let's skip all the way to 3175.
This is
where Tar Palantir, who is Miriel's father, this is where he repents. And he's also in the show right now in the timeline. So the rings haven't been forged, but in the books that happens in 1200.
Well, let's back that up for a quick second, because at this point we are still not sure which rings have been forged, if any. And I think that is going to be a reveal that we are still yet to see. I mean, we don't know if the 9 for men and 7 for dwarves, if those first 16 were forged and we're still waiting on the final 3. We just really have not been told in the show what is going on with that yet.
That's true. So we're not sure if the rings have been forged yet, but
I think it's a reasonable assumption that the one is not. Sorry.
The one has definitely not been forged. But yeah. I'm going to say that if the rings have been forged, the three certainly have not, and the one hasn't. And these are events that had happened, if we were going with the book lore timeline, way prior to, say, the Numenoreans hating the elves and Tar Palantir existing, or Ar-Pharazôn taking the throne, or Elendil and Isildur existing. These people wouldn't exist for about 2,000 years from the forging of the rings. So either we're moving the forging of the rings about 2,000 years down the timeline, or we're moving everything else in front of that timeline and compressing it all into one.
Yes.
So that's how we can see it. What are the three conflicts with Sauron? Well, the one is, like I said, the first war in 1693. The second conflict is his surrender to Ar-Pharazôn, and that happens in 3255. And then, of course, we have him becoming the consigliere to Ar-Pharazôn and convincing him to attack the Valar. And this happens in around 3319. And so Ar-Pharazôn and Elendil and Isildur, they all exist pretty much simultaneously. And then finally, of course, we have the last alliance of elves and men, which is going to be 3430, ending the Second Age.
Nowhere near in the show, even.
We're not near it in the show, but we're a lot closer than 2,000 years away.
It's
all happening within the lifespan of these characters. So,
yes.
You know, it's almost like, you know, Julius Caesar, MacArthur, and, you know, I don't know.
That other guy.
All these different people from different eras in history fighting together. Probably fighting, who is it, Aberdorf Linkler?
That's a deep cut.
Which, as you know, is a combination of Abraham Lincoln and Adolf Hitler from Rick and Morty.
Yes.
So now let's... So we have a lot of timeline compression. Does it make the show bad? Not for me. I still love the way the characters develop. And I have to say that the arc of the characters can still be very similar to the text. We will see our Farazone taking Sauron prisoner, perhaps, and then allying with him to attack the Valar. So, Jude, what's your opinion of this timeline situation?
Well, I think that, to go back to what I said earlier, it's one thing when you're reading it in a book and you're analyzing the show saying, well, this doesn't line up with that and blah, 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 blah. But for most people who have not read the books, and that is most of the fans of the show, we can presume, I think it actually will very likely make it a simpler, more easy to understand narrative than what Tolkien has in, like, the Silmarillion, and even in the appendices of Return of the King, because by compressing the timeline into X number of years, however long it's going to be, 5 years, 10 years, whatever that compression winds up being by the end of the show, the narrative winds up being a much simpler story to tell on screen than what we get in the books. And I feel that while, again, it may piss off a few loyalists to the books, I think that it's the right decision for a television show.
Right. And similar to, you know, Game of Thrones kind of nailed the first four seasons. It was close to the books, but it wasn't as complex and convoluted and didn't have as many plot lines as the books, because you can't, TV just moves too quickly. You will not get all the references that you get while you're slowly intaking a book. It's just a totally different thing. However, I think it would be totally cool if we saw maybe like the stories from the Silmarillion. Can we let those loose and just see like an animated version? I'm thinking of like Genndy Tartakovsky's Primal, that kind of animation with these Tolkien tales from the Silmarillion. Beren and Lúthien would look amazing, and I think it could translate well into the gravitas that he puts into those animated shows. With or without the language would still probably work, because just the visuals and the music are so compelling.
Yeah, I think that would be a terrific idea, and I would love to see it. That being said, given the nature of the show and what we know as watchers in a meta context, we kind of know that because anything that is not in the appendices that's only referenced in the Silmarillion or other works is not available, at least from this production, we can count out and kind of determine that we're just, unfortunately, not going to get that right now.
Yeah, but I can dream. I can dream, Jude. I have a dream. Well, it's different.
Well, you can dream about 37 Minotaurs taking you on a romantic getaway, but it's probably not going to happen.
But I took time off in April.
Yeah, sorry, man. I hate to break it to you.
All right, so let's talk about Galadriel. Did you know that Galadriel has a husband, ladies and gentlemen? She's got a Celeborn.
She does have a Celeborn, doesn't she?
And she was married to him throughout the Second Age. And, you know, they did spend some time apart. But in this show, I don't even know, does she have a husband? It seems like she's an independent lady.
Also, just for the people who don't know, Celeborn is not just the name of a certain special toy for her.
It's also the name of a tree. Thank you, J.R.R. Tolkien. Thanks for naming trees the same as you name elves. You couldn't think of a different name for a tree?
And that's exactly where I was going with that one, too.
So, and they lived in Eregion, so that's, you know, sort of accurate. And that's where Celebrimbor presides and forges the rings with the Gwythai Merdine. And the Gwythai Merdine, if you don't know, are the they are the elven ringsmiths who combine forces unwittingly with Sauron, and he teaches them how to make rings of power. And they work from 1200 to 1600 on those goddamn rings. They work a long time on them rings.
Yes, and we've yet to meet them in the show yet.
There's no Gwythai. They'll be there.
They may be. We just have not met them. We may see them, but right now, they ain't there.
I'm just picturing them riding on those choppers like the Any Which Way But Loose movies, you know, and when the sax comes in and they're all riding on their Harleys and they're like a little biker gang.
That's what this show is missing, is Harleys.
Yes, the Gwythai Merdine. So
some headbands and leather jackets. Yeah.
Did you know it was Galadriel in the lore who warns Celebrimbor of Sauron? She's the one to tell him that, hey, someone's messing around with the controls.
Yeah, she don't trust that boy. And she does not trust him.
So she tells, after he has forged, Celebrimbor's forged the three elven rings, she tells him that they're in danger of Sauron, which is in character for her in this production. Also, in 1693, when the war between Sauron and the elves begins, Celebrimbor is then... He's killed in 1697, and you know what? Sauron is going to use him as a banner, use his body as a banner. And then after he's tortured...
Hey, spoilers.
It's spoilers, but these books have been out forever. All you have to do is read the books. It's not a spoiler. We don't know what's happening in the show. We don't know who Sauron is. We don't know when he's... It spoils the books, maybe, but this is a book lore to show comparison. So
are you telling me that he may end up, settling down in a cottage somewhere deep in Mirkwood with a little lady elf and raising a family? I don't see that happening.
Celebrimbor, he's clearly going to go into it. He's going to go into accounting. Ladies and gentlemen, our Celebrimbor is—he's not what I thought we were going to get. He does not look elfy. He looks accountant-y.
Yes, I was thinking insurance salesman.
Okay, that's fine. So, but before Sauron can get the three elven rings, Celebrimbor is going to give one to Gil-galad in Lindon, and Círdan, the shipwright, also in Lindon. And he's going to give one to Lady Galadriel in Eregion. So we're going to see if that happens. And did you know that after the war between Sauron and the elves, she moves to Rivendell? She gets a nice little loft in Rivendell, and she goes and lives there with... Celebrimbor, who is her daughter, and Celebrimbor then marries Elrond, and they live together. Like cats and dogs. Not like cats and dogs, like dogs and dogs, because they're elves and elves.
That would be a little weird.
So, I would like to talk a little bit now. Now that we're we're really cleaning house here, we're going through everything. Let's talk about Numenor, since this whole episode was much of it was set in Numenor, and we all know it's the Island Kingdom. It was given to the Edain, the men who stood against Morgoth.
And now know that it's pronounced Numenor.
Numenor. Okay, and Elros. You know what, Elros? He changed his name to Tar Minyatar. And how tall were the Numenoreans supposed to be, Jude?
Well, we know on average they were about 7 feet tall. And as we pointed out on the last show, some of them reached heights a good deal taller than that.
And yeah, Elendil, he's supposed to be 7 foot 11. And,
yes, he is.
So, originally, the Numenoreans were actually really good friends with the elves, particularly the Noldor. The Noldor taught them lots of things about building ships and working with iron. And Gil-galad gave them many gifts. And then, in turn, they sailed to the mainland, and they shared their knowledge of agriculture and working of iron with the men of Middle Earth, who kind of like thought, hey, these guys are fucking awesome.
It's almost like they're our ancestors or something.
They're tall. They're good looking.
And that makes them better.
They know how to work the iron.
That sounds dirty.
They must be gods.
Can we go back there? I mean, come on.
So, now in 1695.
It was a good year.
We talked about this guy, Tar Minas Tirith. He was the Numenorean king that helped defeat Sauron when Sauron came for them rings. So that was also the time when Numenor started to divide between the king's men and the faithful. It just, the seeds of it started after the defeat of Sauron. And by the time they get to Tar Atanamir, that's going to be in 2251, that's the point where they really start to hate the elves and turn against the elves. And Jude, do you know why they don't like the elves so much?
Did it have anything to do with that dinner party where that one elf, you know, relieved himself on the table there? Oh, I mean, it's a famous story.
You mean Joey?
Yeah, Tolkien wrote about it, like, in detail.
Well,
a little hard to find, but he definitely did, I'm sure of it.
Maybe so, but really what we're looking at is lifespan envy.
So not the Joey issue.
No, it is the fact that elves live virtually forever, and the Numenoreans did not. And as a matter of fact, I think as they became less faithful to the gods, their lifespan decreased. But they did take a fall morally. And pretty soon, the Numenoreans start to become actually cruel overlords to the men of Middle-earth on the coast, where they used to show them how to plant things and work the iron. Now they're the douchebags. So the Numenoreans, really, when they lost faith in the gods, they became big assholes, and I think that's what we're looking at in the show. We're looking at the fractured society. We're looking at the king's men versus the minority faithful, and we're looking at people who think they're better than other men, as we saw them talking to Halbrand and calling him low man. And
honestly, I think it's just a surname, you know, Loman. Like, it's going to become that. It's all good. I don't have any concerns.
It's death of a Halbrand. Halbrand Loman.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, he's going to start a construction business. Loman's, you know, roofing and siding. And it all works out well, I'm sure.
I think he's going to be a salesman. Death of a salesman, you see, Jude? Read a book.
Yeah, but you know what? You know what? But then he's going to be having conflicts with Celebrimbor, and I don't want to see that.
So let's talk about the White Tree of Numenor. And its name is Nimloth. Because, you know, if I had a tree, I would name it Nimloth.
That tree would get made fun of so much as a child.
Nimloth.
Its sapling years are going to be rough, like going to elementary school. I don't want to see that.
Do you know where Nimloth comes from, though? Where that particular, the family tree of that tree, if you will?
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't trying to do that. I was just trying to speak. So, Nimloth comes from originally Telperion, which is one of the trees in Aman that gets poisoned by Morgoth.
And Ungoliant. Don't forget that, bitch.
And Ungoliant.
Ungoliant, rather. Sorry.
The big giant, the spider.
I don't like spiders.
And sometimes depicted with like a woman's body inside the body of the spider. Like it's a woman spider.
Yeah, that's. I think that's very much an artistic depiction. I don't believe Tolkien described it as that at all.
Sexy lady spider.
I don't want to see that either.
Yvanna, the goddess, used the sapling of Telperion to create Goliathian, another tree from sapling from Telperion. And then that sapling, they took a sapling from Golithian, and that became the tree known as Celeborn. Thank you. Celeborn the tree.
Celeborn, the husband of Galadriel.
Right, the tree
husband of Galadriel.
And then the sapling from Celeborn was given to the Numenoreans, and that's Nimloth. So this tree that we see Muriel talking about with Elendil and saying that people believe that the falling leaves from the tree represent the tears of the god as they judge us, that would be Nimloth. And then the Isildur will take the sapling of Nimloth, and that's going to become the White Tree of Gondor that we see in the Lord of the Rings movies. And the significance of the white trees is they represent faith. Faith in the Valar.
And although we're going to point this out, I'm sure, when we get around to reviewing the movies, that tree in the book, what happens to that tree in the book? Because it's different than in the movies. It does not come back to life and flourish when the king comes back. Rather, in the books, what happens to it?
I don't know. You tell me, Jude.
It dies. That tree actually dies in the books. What's put in its place is yet another sapling taken from that tree. And it's more about lineage, not about a magical coming back to life. It's about the lineage representing the life carrying on from generation to generation.
Right. So I'm also going to point out that Muriel is using the tree as a backdrop to discuss the faithful and being an elf friend. And the thing that I want to point out is that certainly we have to understand that Muriel is hiding the fact that she's actually faithful, and not she's acting like she's not faithful in that moment. But we see at the end of the show that she goes to her father, Tar Palantir, the repentant, and she tells him, yeah, the elf is here and all that stuff. The prophecy is going to be enacted at this point. So, important plot point, because there is going to be something that happens with Farazan, and he's actually Muriel's cousin. And if she is, in my opinion, my prediction is she's going to represent the faithful. Eventually, she's going to come out as faithful. Aid Galadriel with an army and Halbrand. We'll see how that works out. We're going to talk about Halbrand too.
I'd rather just speak about Halbrand 1, to be honest with you.
Halbrand 2. That's where he fights Mr. T.
Oh, God, I want to see that.
A pitiful.
Will he fight Hulk Hogan, too?
Oh, yeah. That happens. All
right, then we're
it's
good.
It's not until Halbrand 4. No, it's Halbrand 2, he just fights Apollo Creed again. But, so let's talk about Halbrand.
Let's do that.
Jude's got some Halbrand lore, and well, not lore, he's not in fucking books. But he's going to tell you about some Halbrand theories.
Okay, well, we've discussed the two most popular theories, the fact that he's either Sauron, because everyone's got to be Sauron, someone's Sauron in this. We don't think anyone is yet, but that's just our educated guess right now. So we're just going to shoot that theory down and crush your dreams a little bit. Number two is one which I like quite a bit, and that is the idea that Halbrand may very well be one of the Nazgul, if not the Witch King. And we've got some evidence pointing us there, in particular the idea that Galadriel points out at the end of the episode that Halbrand is a king where he comes from, even though he tries to deny it. She's not having any of that. So the idea that we know the rings will be close to all of our main characters in some capacity. You know, the title of the show spoils it a little bit, Rings of Power. The Kings of Men are the ones to get the Nine for Men and eventually become the Nazgul. So, the idea that he is getting close to Galadriel, and even though we've got some indication that he may not be as good as he seems, I think the idea that he may go back and become a king among men, take his place, and ultimately receive one of the Rings of Power seems to be a strong theory. So we've got that going on. Then a theory which I was introduced to on the internet and I'm very fond of is the idea that perhaps Halbrand could very well be one of the founders of the Rohirrim eventually, the men who become the Rohirrim, because they don't exist yet in the timeline as far as we know with the show, even with compression. It seems a little much to break the lore that much. So if that is in fact the case, there is a number of reasons which this could potentially be. And this was brought to us by a user on Facebook who says that they break down a number of reasons, four main reasons, in fact. Number one, which is maybe the most obvious, is the promo posters we got for the show, which show Halbrand with a sword featuring a horse head hilt. I'm sorry. Let me take that back. A horse head pommel, rather. And the design looks very close to a lot of the artwork we have seen both throughout the years as well as in the Peter Jackson movies that are associated with the Rohirrim. So that is a big head-scratching moment. Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, to me, there's really nothing other than that that specifically would tie him into Rohan. But that's a big one. So you can't the fact that he has that sword is, you know, maybe it's the one thing, but it's a pretty important one. I think the fact that any time you have a king, someone who may possibly be a king in this show, he might possibly become a goddamn Nazgul. You got to get to Nazgul before they spring. You got to get them.
The evidence for him. I'm sorry. Go on.
Well, the main thing that I want to say is more of a meta. What I think is a meta topic, and that is, they're not going to tell you who is who until like season 3 or season 4. So everybody who's making predictions on these early characters and especially in the early stage, the embryonic stage of the character development, is probably jumping the gun. They need you to wonder who Sauron is. They need you to conspire and wonder who these characters are going to become by the end of the season 5. So,
yes.
You know, they're going to leave you guessing. I don't think we're going to get Sauron season 1, season 2 at all. We're going to get a series of lesser bad guys like Adda. Go ahead.
Well, you know, you make a good point about that, and I agree. However, this Facebook user, let me give credit where credit is due. The name is Anna Louise Nelson, if you're listening, shout-outs, pointed out more than just the promo poster. They also pointed out the fact that we've seen Halbrand several times doing things which would give credence to someone of that eventual bloodline, such as a talent, or at least a proclaimed talent for blacksmithing, which is not something that someone like Sauron would necessarily do. It's, you know, working arms and armor and things like that, steel smithing and iron smithing. That's something that is very closely tied in the Tolkien lore to the Rohirrim.
What do you mean Sauron wouldn't do that? Who do you think makes Sauron's fancy-ass armor?
Well, Sauron was primarily, as far as we know, interested in being a ringsmith, hence his type of creation. So again, that's a minor piece, but it's it's one of the pieces of evidence. We're not done yet. There's more.
Thank God, because you're not beating a dead horse lord here. Okay, he might be Rohan. We get it.
All right.
Is there more? Please?
There's. Oh, no, there's.
More of that. What else is there?
There's more, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger. It just keeps kind of growing like it's getting excited there.
Oh, God. If Nails on a Chalkboard could say some disgusting shit, it would be Jude Fox. Go ahead, Jude.
Why, thank you. I really only aspire to such a level of annoyance.
You don't need to aspire. You're there, baby.
Oh, thank you. So, anyway, So let's get into some of the even bigger reasons. That includes the music, which is being used as his themes. As a musician, Rob, I think you may have a bit of an opinion on this one. And that is that Bear McCreary has been using elements of the score to represent Halbrand, which include, what is it, the Norwegian Hardanger fiddle, I believe it's called. And it's a obscure and antiquated instrument, which, interestingly enough, is the same instrument, though, that Howard Shore used to represent the Rohirrim and its people. So yes. That's an interesting tie-in to the possibility of him being a proto-Rohirrim of some sort. And then beyond that, we have his name. Which apparently is Rohirric, and actually means a strong sword in Old English, and it's the language which Tolkien derived from the Old English in order to represent the Rohirrim. And so I think the evidence that's laid out is more than just a simple passing of, I think it's this person. I think we do have some pretty good evidence to at least look towards, not necessarily be convinced yet, but I think it's a strong case that's been made here.
Yeah, well, there you have it. He's definitely the founder of Rohan, Jude Fox. So,
or possibly.
Is one thing I'd like to point out, though, since we're doing a little bit of a meta thing with the production of the show. I love the music. The music is great, but I'm still waiting for something to grab me, like the theme that Howard Shore came up with for The Ring. That haunting, that Bear McCreary, as great as he is, I still haven't been captivated by one theme that I can't get out of my head. So that's one criticism that I have. So the music, great in general, really beautiful, fitting, works for the show. I'm waiting for that iconic theme that haunts me, that I can't, that really sets the overall theme. When you sit there and you watch Lord of the Rings and you hear that theme come in, you're ready to watch some Lord of the Rings. You know, that theme really gets you. And I haven't gotten there yet with Bear McCreary, and it's not taking anything away from what he's done, but just to be a little critical there. I think you could say, maybe you brought up the issue of depth of field, which I didn't feel was an issue in Lord of the Rings. It's a similar point, but only in the visual realm. So what do you think about the depth of field?
Yeah, I am. Something I've been noticing as a filmmaker is that the production values, once again, amazing. I think everything looks beautiful. That being said, I've been taking a little bit of an issue with the depth of field, as I mentioned to Rob there, and that is that when compositing multiple layers, especially created in the digital realm, it's important for the effects artists and the compositing artists to keep the depth of field in mind, and that is to say that what's in the foreground is generally sharper, and the further we get each layer, the more out of focus it becomes, the blurrier it becomes. And when I look at a lot of these shots, as spectacular as they are sometimes, like when we first come into Numenor, as amazing as it looks, there is a lot of times a certain flatness, and I felt this in the previous episodes as well, that it almost looks as if the artists are afraid to lose some of their production value and the detail that's gone into the layers going back, that they're keeping things a little bit too in focus, and it, to me, is making the show look somewhat flat, you know, somewhat like you would experience of things shot on video, like old soap operas. And that is perhaps just from a visual standpoint, the one big gripe I have. I've noticed that when I wear glasses, and when I wear my glasses, it looks very video to me. When I take my glasses off, it looks cinematic. It looks beautiful because everything's a little bit blurrier. And I think that is an unfortunate issue that multiple shows and movies even I've seen running into. And we get that a little bit in actually Peter Jackson's Hobbit movies, although not in his Lord of the Rings, because once again, it was all done digitally and they wanted to show everything on screen. And that is a problem from a filmmaking standpoint, is wanting to show too much in your shot when we're talking about depth of field. So it's something to keep in mind, to look at. Again, I don't think it takes away too much from the show, but I think it does become a little bit distracting, and it's a little bit of an issue for me, I gotta tell you.
When it's almost like when you very first got your first like high def TV, and you went from the old school thick ass TV to the flat screen with the high def, and you were like, this looks a little, it's really clear, but it looks a little video-y, flat. But I don't really have, you know, the difference between this and Peter Jackson's movies looked not The Hobbit, but The Lord of the Rings had a more natural feel. And Game of Thrones has a show that has that much CGI in it, I think they darken it enough to really minimize that effect.
Well, I to give credit to a show like Game of Thrones or the new one, House of the Dragon, I think that a lot of their sets were at least more semi-practical. I believe they used more miniatures and things like that.
As with Lord of the Rings.
Right. And when you're doing that, you can put the work into the camera to make it look closer to the way the human eye perceives. When you're doing it, when you have a composite artist doing it on a screen, once again, there is a strong inclination to not make things too blurry, because some other artist went out and rendered a background that took them 3 weeks to create for a 6-second shot. And so there is often a fear of losing all that money that went into there and that value. And so what you get is you get a less natural, often, not always, depth of field. And I think that's what we're seeing here, really, is, you know, again, with Game of Thrones, most of it had a much more proper depth of field because, once again, you're using those natural sets, even if they're miniatures.
We need a little bit more Monet in this.
I would go Seurat.
Is it fan fiction? Are we looking at fan fiction? Is it adaptation or is it fan fiction? Are we that far from the actual text, from the actual lore? And what I say is yes and no, because I think that the characters, even though they're placed out of time and maybe there are some certain original characters that are thrown into place and we have different ethnicities in it, I think the acting and the character arcs are going to be similar in a lot of ways. I think the characteristics of the characters, the qualities of the characters are going to tie it together to the lore. So overall, the final question is it good TV? Is it entertaining? It is not Tolkien. He might not like it himself. But to me, it entertains me, and I find it interesting, obviously, to talk about, and I like the way everything is building so far. That's so far. We don't know. Maybe it could, you know, immediately jump a shark. I don't know. But so far, so good for me. I really enjoy the Harfoots. I don't care about ethnicity in fantasy that wasn't originally intended by the author. Look, you know, okay, so maybe there weren't, you know, we have an African-American actor playing Sadak. We have an African-American actor playing an elf around here.
I believe they're actually both British, but...
Okay.
Yeah.
But still of color. I see Asian Harfoots, and people are like, well, they didn't have that in Middle Earth and this and that, and maybe they should be from the South, they should be from the East, mainly the bad guys. You know what else they didn't have? They didn't have Middle Earth. It's all a fantasy. None of this stuff existed, so it could be whatever the people who are creating it want it to be. And if you can't suspend disbelief for ethnicity in a show, how are you suspending it for dark lords and all the other magical shit that's happening? You know, there's fell beasts fighting giant eagles, there's hobbits, there's Harfoots, there's elves who live forever. You can't suspend some disbelief that
I think,
you know, Harfoot might be of color. Just relax with that and go with it and watch the story, you know.
That's yeah, how I think I think that there are issues both more to the point of Tolkien as well as in general, and let me first address Tolkien himself, and that is that people are, number one, forgetting, I feel, that Tolkien was writing a, once again, as you pointed out, Rob, fantasy story about different races coming together to overcome evil and to blend together. The very end of Lord of the Rings ends with the marriage, more or less, of an elf and a human, two different races.
And know what, Jude?
Yep.
You know why?
Why is this?
Because what it's really all about is the friends we made along the way.
And moreover, I think, you know, Tolkien was not a fucking racist, people. So, you know, I think he would have had major, going back to the discussion about, you know, the adaption, and would Tolkien approve? No, he wouldn't have approved of it because he hated adaptions. You know, he had a big issue with anyone changing the material which he envisioned in his head, because he had a vision in his head and he knew that nobody could create the world that he saw, but that wasn't why he created it. He created it so that you could have your own interpretation, and this is someone's interpretation of that. And I think from that aspect, even if he didn't like the adaptation in particular, because I don't think he would have liked any of them, no matter how quote-unquote faithful, I feel he would have very likely, at least, approved the concept of this. And beyond that, something which people tend to forget about is that he himself almost never described any of his characters' skin colors. The closest he ever came to that in any of his writings was describing someone as quote-unquote fair, or having fair skin,
swarthy.
Or having a fair form.
He described the people from the South as swarthy.
Right, yes, but again, it was not a direct description of their skin colors. It wasn't a description of, you know, oh, did they have Asian eyes or not? It had very little to do with that, and he was very vague on it, and I think that was intentional.
I don't know if Tolkien, I mean, he was not racist for a person of that era, but I can't speak for, you know, what we would consider him today if you were having a conversation with him.
I don't think he necessarily was saying one way or the other is the point. You know, if he had made a point of it, if he had said, yeah, you know, this person is, you know, white, this person is dark-skinned, like, that's one thing. He basically did not do that with his writings about Middle-earth. You know, it's very, very little of any of – little if any of that. And, you know, I think the concept of interpretation was, again, something he was striving for, was for people to interpret, you know, as they read. And I don't think he would have necessarily wanted someone, a person of color, to be reading going, oh, gee, that's not me. I don't think that was where he was coming from. Again, I'm speculating, fair enough. But from the interviews I've heard of his and as he spoke and hearing, you know, his children and grandchildren speak about him and how he viewed his work, that's at least my interpretation of how he presented it, was to let people come up with their ideas and hopefully put themselves into that, which is what a lot of authors do wish, you know, not all, but a lot of them. So I think that's important to bring into this conversation beyond, oh, well, you know, it's based on medieval Europe and, you know, no, it's not. It's Middle Earth. That's not medieval Europe. Sorry, buddy. It's just not. Right. And, you know, and then, you know, on a, to go back to a more meta commentary on it, the other day I was having a conversation with a good friend of mine, a woman who is a woman of color. And she is very unfamiliar with Tolkien's work. She told me she has never before seen any of the movies, any of The Lord of the Rings, any of The Hobbit, not the animated stuff, and she's never read any of the books. However, she began watching the show. And she told me that when she saw people of color in these, you know, represented in the different races, in the dwarves and in the halflings, the Harfoots, and in the elves, she said that she almost cried, that she felt like her and her daughter were being represented for the first time in this kind of media, you know, like on this scale. And I think that that is much, much more important than any of these other conversations or people that, you know, are all butthurt about not everyone being white. You know, it's like, not everyone's white. The only people that shouldn't be white are the orcs. Like, no, go fuck yourself. Sorry.
Right.
Like, it's just not how it is.
So, with that, I think we pretty much covered everything that we wanted to say about episode 3. Adda. Adda himself, he's going to be a fallen elf, I believe. And we're going to see possibly a new type of character. That Tolkien didn't include. There were no evil elves, so to speak. There were corrupted elves, orcs, corrupted by Morgoth and turned into this other species. But we're going to see something new tonight. Hopefully, we're going to see a little bit more of Adda while we watch later tonight. But it's about time to wrap up this deep dive, Jude. And
Before we do, there is a point or two I think we are still missing from our last podcast and that we haven't discussed. And a big part. We really in Adar got our first good look at the orcs in this show, and they look nothing like what the showrunners, in fact, deemed the orc in the kitchen that we saw attack Bronwyn and her son in the kitchen. in their little cottage. So what are we thinking that that means about that creature? Like, is that in fact an orc now? Or are we still wondering if maybe that's a little something else?
It looked different. I don't know. Maybe they just wanted a little more, you know, pizzazz in that scene. Who knows? It had a beard. The orcs don't really have that. It had those long, weird claws. It seemed to be taller than an orc, more
stronger,
powerful. Maybe it's, I mean, they didn't call it the troll in the kitchen. It wasn't a troll.
No.
We've seen the snow troll doesn't look anything like that. And then we have the warg versus the wolves. And that warg, I don't know, it seemed to have some pig going on in there. It seemed to have some boar, especially the way it, like, toppled that guy with its head before it ripped into his guts. A bit of an inconsistency, like you said, with the cut of the throat and the no blood, tiny little paper cut for the PG-ish TV rating, and then the warg just rips people's guts right out,
like straight up NC-17.
Yeah. So okay. So we brought that into the conversation, something to think about. Maybe
so
we're going to see more of those weird non-orc orcs. Maybe they're like a special division of the orcs, the tunneling kind.
Yeah.
Who knows?
We had that. We also, quick mention, the fact that, and we spoke about her in the previous episode, but Elendil's daughter.
She's a show character.
Elendil's daughter is a show-only character,
mm-hmm.
Which, once again, deviating from the books, where he has two sons only. But I think that this could be an interesting way for, once again, the show to use that character to go in a direction they want to go that doesn't contradict or have anything to do with Tolkien's writings. How do you feel about that, Rob?
I think it's, you know, it's just another character in the show. We'll see where it goes. I don't think I got anything to say about it right now. I think it's time that we wrap it up. And this is the JRR You Talking to Me podcast. I'm Rob Law, my co-host, Jude Fox. I'm going to bid you a fond adieu. And Jude, you going to take us out with some information?
I absolutely will. First of all, I want to give a great big thank you to our co-host who is not with us today, Rowan. Rowan had a little bit of an issue. As you may have remembered, he is still suffering a bit and being taken care of by his lady nurse, girlfriend, something else, whatever the heck she is. I didn't hear about that. What I did hear is why he claimed he couldn't be with us tonight. You know what that is, Rob?
Oh, no, you know more about that than me.
Yeah, no. He didn't tell me about the relationship, and once again, Rowan, I'm sorry to hear that, man. But, apparently his cat ended up with some kind of digestive issue and was just puking up and had to be brought to the vet. And, he told me that he could not bring it to the vet and was going to attempt to nurse it back to health himself, which he's not a veterinarian. I really don't know how that's going to go, but good luck. Yeah.
Yep, good luck to Rohan. And once again, I will bid you a fond adieu. Jude, why don't you take us out?
So, once again, I'm Jude Fox. And if you'd like to reach us, you can find us at youtalkingtome@gmail.com. That's youtalkingtome@gmail.com. Or on Facebook at the You Talking to Me About the Fellowship group. In addition, you can find us on all of your favorite podcast apps. Please like, rate us 5 stars, and share with your friends to help grow the fellowship. Until next week, or until Sunday, I am out of here.